21-1511, United States v. Samuel Arce Ayala. At this time, would Attorney Castro Lang please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, Attorney Rafael Castro Lang, and I represent Appellant Arce Ayala. Before I begin, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Your Honor, the record in this case is clear that Arce Ayala was led to believe by his lawyer, the prosecutor, and the judge at the change of plea hearing that he would be credited at sentencing the 64 months, 29 days he had served in his local related case. Now, unfortunately, because there is a mandatory minimum of 10 years in his case, by the time he was sentenced, had already finished.
But since we're talking about a minimum, couldn't the taking account of the credit just restrict what the maximum would be so he got what he was expecting?
Your Honor, you know, I think that's cutting the scissors real thin and making an argument that you might be able to win the case that you should lose. Every inmate, Your Honor, the most important matter in a sentence is how much time I'm going to do.
Isn't that consistent with the idea that you're now being told that the maximum is going to be set accounting for the credit?
No, I think it's a false argument.
He was apprised of the mandatory minimum, wasn't he?
With all due respect, Your Honor.
Well, just
I want to answer that. If you look at the plea agreement, it specifically makes reference the local cases, and then it makes reference to United States Sentencing Guidelines, 5G13 and 52K21. Those are two guidelines that specifically deal with credits in related cases, and they contemplate that a reduction can be made in 5G13, it's undischarged, in 52K21, discharged. And the 5K21 departs, says the judge can depart downward.
I don't think you answered my question. Was he apprised of the mandatory minimum? Is there indication that at the time of the plea he knew about the mandatory minimum?
Yes, of course he knew about the mandatory minimums, but he's not a lawyer. He's not a lawyer, Your Honor. The whole motions, even his lawyer, court-appointed lawyer, acknowledges that throughout the whole proceeding, that what he was expected and what his lawyer told him was that the judge could go below the 10-year mandatory minimum. Now, there's nothing in the sentence hearing that supports the government's argument that, that time was already taken into account when we both recommended 120 months. If you look at the sentencing transcript, Appendix 187, Judge Bezosa never states, I have taken into account the 60 months, 29 days that you deserve a reduction, and that has been taken into account when I have imposed the 120 months. Now, what did he do? Impose an illegal concurrent sentence. Your case law is clear that once a sentence is extinguished, you can't impose a concurrent sentence. So there's nothing in the record that supports the interpretation of the plea raised by the government. And in fact,
Counsel, let me ask you this, please. The court says to your client, this is early in the at the change of plea hearing. That means, Mr. Arch, that whatever time you spent in the state court will be given credit for that time when I sentence you in this case. Now, the judge says you'll get credit but the judge never explains what that credit means. And my understanding is that it fell to defense counsel to explain to his client what that credit meant. And defense counsel, as reflected in the motion that he submits to the court, in his sentencing memorandum, he's quite clear that what he understands credit to be is you will actually be given credit for that term of imprisonment, so that he will get full time credit for that 60 months of imprisonment. That will actually be deducted from the sentence imposed. I mean, I gather that's your argument, right? That the judge never explained what credit meant. Defense counsel explained what it meant in a way that is legally incorrect. And so in that sense, he did not enter a knowing plea. He had a fundamental misunderstanding of what credit meant when he entered the plea.
Of course, he did not make a knowing voluntary plea, because that reduction was the central clause that motivated him to accept guilt. And the judge reinforced my argument. My argument is reinforced by the judge when he told him, when I sentence you, I'm going to credit you the 64 months. Now, what can a reasonable person interpret with that statement that you're going to receive 64 months reduction? That's a far cry from what happened here, that the judge, without mentioning anything about the credit he promised him at the change of plea, merely imposes a sentence of mandatory minimums.
But did the judge in the colloquy informing your client identify there being a mandatory minimum?
Identify what?
Identifying that there would be a mandatory minimum.
Yes, the mandatory minimums were mentioned, but
by the judge?
Yes, he had mandatory minimum.
I guess the difficulty is when we say it wasn't explained, the judge says you have a mandatory minimum sentence of X.
No, because
Judge
Lopez stated, he was misled but he thought that even though there was a mandatory 10-year minimum, the judge could reduce his sentence to 64 months as promised.
Well, why would he have? Go ahead, Judge Lopez.
But counsel, just to follow up on Judge Barron's point, this again is the court saying to your client, do you understand that as the count one, the drug count, by law, I cannot sentence you to anything less than 10 years? I mean, that seems to be a clear statement of the mandatory minimum, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, again, Let's look at section 5G13. If his sentence would have been undischarged, the court under 5G1.3 would have had the authority to adjust the sentence even if there was a mandatory minimum. Because the way they do this, I have a brief that I found just yesterday that deals with this issue. What the judge does when you have a mandatory minimum and an undischarged term in prison, let's say it's 10 years, you sentence him to 10 years, and after you sentence him, you adjust the 10 years with the amount of reduction that he should receive.
But that seems to cut against you, because you don't do that when there's a mandatory minimum.
Oh, when you have a mandatory minimum, the judge can, what he can do is credit.
He can't go below.
Yes, they do.
The mandatory minimum?
Yes. As long as they sentence, what they can't do is say, let's say you have a mandatory minimum of 10, and with the reduction, you have 8. What the judge can't say is, I'm going to sentence you to 8 years and forget the 10 years. He says, no, I'm going to sentence you to 10 years. He's already complied with the mandatory minimum. And then he says, but I'm going to adjust the sentence on the related case.
Oh, I see.
And what we want here is to achieve just sentences, Your Honor. We're not here in a game of who wins, who loses. These are people's lives that are behind bars.
Okay.
And what is just And what the guidelines are meant to affect is have related sentences be taken into account and deducted when the individual is sentenced. That way you avoid double jeopardy, and you also impose a sentence that is just because that time has already been taken account.
No. Just one last question. There's some risk if you win that you get a longer sentence, right?
I don't see any risk to this. The law.
Well, you're asking to get out of
this. This is a defendant that was misled.
I know, but you're asking to get out of the plea, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Well, you're asking to get out of the plea, right?
Yes.
So isn't there some risk that on what is going to happen if, in fact, a mandatory minimum has to be imposed?
Theoretically.
What is the reason to think you're going to end up with a sentence less than the one you've got now? And that all it would seem to be is that there's some risk you get more of a sentence. So if we're talking about justice for your client, it's a little bit.
Theoretically, you're right. Theoretically, you're right. But at this stage, all of the defendants have pled. This would be the only one. I represented defendant number 4, and he got a plea of 3.5 but less than 5 kilos.
Okay. Does want to call on? Does the Pez anything further?
Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, counsel for the government would please introduce himself on the record to begin.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Ricardo Imbert for the United States. The court did not err by denying the defendant's motion to withdraw the plea agreement because there was no fair and just reason to justify doing so. Your Honor, at a change of plea agreement, the defendant was appraised by the court that it could not sentence him to anything less than 10 years as to one count and 5 years as to the other. The court also advised the defendant that the guidelines were advisory, explained how the guidelines work, and warned the defendant that it could impose a sentence far more severe than that recommended by the plea agreement. The defendant certified that he was not induced to plead guilty by any promise or assurance.
Counsel, excuse me, the court did not just advise him that he could impose a sentence more severe than the plea agreement. He also said, I could impose a sentence less severe
than
the plea agreement. That's unmistakable from the record, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't that phrase inform the client's understanding, which he insists that he's had throughout this proceeding, and his own counsel confirms this, that he anticipated that he would get a less severe sentence by getting credit for the discharge term of that 64 months. And the judge, again, only refers generally that you're going to get credit for that time meaning those 64 months when I sentence you in this case. So he's told you're going to get credit for it. I have the right to impose a less severe sentence than it's been agreed to. And then you have his own attorney in documents filed with the court saying that he repeatedly told his client that he would get, under the agreement, he would get credit for that 64 months. To me, I would suggest that all adds up to a client who did not enter a knowing plea in the sense that he understood what the sentencing consequences were going to be. How do you refute the notion that he did not enter a knowing plea under these circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to first address the part of your question which pertains to what occurred at the change of plea hearing. And my answer would be that, yes, the court did also tell the defendant that it could impose a sentence less severe than that recommended to the parties. But that is a general warning that the court makes in cases, and it was just informing the defendant about how the guidelines work. More importantly, the court went on to say that it could not impose a sentence of anything less than 10 years or anything less than 5 years as to each count. And that's pretty forceful language as well. Now, Your Honor, you also mentioned...
Are those two statements by the district court inconsistent with one another? I forget what the plea agreement number was.
No, Your Honor. I don't think...
Was the plea agreement number higher than the mandatory minimum?
No, Your Honor. The parties recommended a...
At the minimum, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's what I don't follow. If he told him, I can give you less than the plea agreement, isn't that inconsistent with the statement, I have to give you a sentence of the 5 and 10?
Your Honor, our position is that the government, that the court, when it made that specific statement, was simply notifying the defendant about how the guidelines work.
Well, whatever the intention was, just the literal statement, if I'm listening to these two statements, one, I can give you less than the plea agreement if in your case the plea agreement's 120. And then I say, but I can't give you less than 120. Haven't I just said two irreconcilable things?
Well, Your Honor, if that's true, the second statement by the court in which the court appraised the defendant about the relevant statutory minimums would have cured any misunderstanding
I think the concern is that from the perspective of the one listening to it, all I know is I've been told two irreconcilable things. And then in addition to the two irreconcilable things, I've been told I'm going to get a credit of 45. So I don't know whether that means – it's hard to know what that means. So doesn't that all go just to the question Judge Lopez is asking, that given what actually transpired at sentencing, it is hard to see how the defendant would have had a clear idea of what the sentence he faced would be?
Your Honor, and I'd also – before I address your question specifically, I'd like to mention that the defendant does not reference that statement in his opening brief and does not make any arguments as to pertain to the court's warning that it could impose a sentence more or less severe than that recommended by the parties. To get to the second part of your question, Your Honor, I would submit that the defendant's arguments are clear, and the record is clear that if there was any misunderstanding on behalf of the defendant about whether he could receive a sentence, a credit below the minimum the statutory minimums, that was due to a misunderstanding or a misapprehension that he had prior to the change of plea colloquy. He himself states multiple times that was due to counsel's...
That's a fair point if the colloquy is clear. But I think as we just were exploring, it's a little hard to see how the colloquy is as clear as you want it to seem to us when there is that statement by the district court that he can give less than 120 months.
Well, Your Honor, I restate that our position is that the court's unequivocal statement that it could not sentence the defendant to anything less than 10 years as to one count and 5 years as to the other clearly notified the defendant that the court could not go below the statutory minimum.
Is that sentence clearer than the sentence that I can give you less than the plea agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it is.
And help me understand. How
well, Your Honor, and I'd also like to point out that there are other ways that the sentence could be less severe than that expected by the defendant, that the court could impose a lesser time of supervised release, for example, and it could
Was that part of the plea agreement?
Your Honor, I cannot answer that question right now, but I'd be glad to file a 28-J motion with that information.
We can look at the document.
Okay.
Judge Monacovo?
Nothing.
Okay. Judge LePez?
Nothing further, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may I make one last point before I step down? I referenced that misapprehension that the defendant could have had would be attributable to his defense counsel's faulty advice, and that inquiry would have to take place within the context of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and the defendant would have to show prejudice, which he cannot, and the defendant would also need a developed record for this court to consider it.
Excuse me, counsel, why wouldn't this be a case where it's unmistakable? There's no question what his attorney was telling him. I mean, it's all over the record. We know the attorney was telling him that you're going to get credit for this prior sentence.
Judge Lopez, I'm sorry to interrupt. Mr. Castro-Lang, could you just take your seat while this is going on longer than we anticipated? Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I got lost there with the interruption with your question.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, there are cases where on direct appeal we can decide ineffective assistance of counsel. The attorney is confessing over and over again to the misguided advice that he gave to his client. He clearly misunderstood the law. He told his client he could get credit for a sentence that he could not legally get credit for. So his ineffectiveness is unmistakable on this record, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, even if that's true, the defendant cannot show that he was prejudiced by his counsel's actions, because he cannot demonstrate that he would have gone on to trial. And in fact, the record is clear that that was never his intent and that he was always looking to accept responsibility for his actions. And he cannot show that he would have received a more favorable plea agreement, because the only way he could do that is if the government agrees to allow him to plead guilty to a charge that includes a lesser drug amount. And in fact, he already tried to negotiate that plea on multiple times, and the government said no and rejected such a plea deal, thereby making clear on the record that the government isn't willing to offer a more favorable deal.
Before you sit down, could you just address Mr. Castro-Lang's point that it would be possible to give less than the 120 months through the adjustment mechanism he was describing?
Well, Your Honor, the adjustment mechanism in this case isn't an adjustment mechanism at all. It's a departure mechanism under Section 5K2.23. And the law is clearly established that it doesn't allow for a court to dip below the statutory minimum sentence. And as to 5G1.3, I believe that it's the government's position that that statute doesn't allow or shouldn't allow for that either.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sorry. Thank you, counsel. At this time, if Attorney Castro-Lang would reintroduce himself on the record, he has a 2-minute rebuttal.
I'm glad they brought up the ineffective assistance. I agree fully with Judge Lopez that both the attorney and the appellant were under the impression that that amount of time was going to be deducted. He confessed to ineffective assistance. The two cases cited by the Supreme Court, one with this case where counsel first did not study the criminal history, and this court on direct appeal reversed because on plain error and a miscalculation of a credit that the defendant was supposed to receive was found to be ineffective assistance of counsel. Here we have a huge instance of ineffective assistance that's clear on the record. What is there to develop? Nothing. So this case falls in that exception that when the record is clear, this court can entertain an ineffective assistance claim.
But what's the prejudice with respect to the withdrawal of the plea? What indicates that he would have withdrawn but for this?
His own statements. I wouldn't have entered into a plea agreement if I had known that I wasn't going to get the 64 months. I don't think we should worry about the future. We have a contract here that was interpreted incorrectly by the defendant. The judge also made some comments that supported his interpretation of the plea. When the judge sentenced him, he never made reference to the 64 months credit to justify the government's position that, oh, when he got the 10 years, the judge was already taking into account the 64 months. So I believe this is a clear-cut case that the court should set aside the judgment, the change, the plea, and the plea agreement, and the plea. Agreement and remand before a different judge, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.